Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. My guest today is Chris Wright, the legendary music entrepreneur, who's also run businesses stretching from TV to top-level sport. The co-founder of Chrysalis Records, Chris guided names including Blondie, Ultravox and Spandau Ballet to global success, challenging the major labels. He went on to launch the Heart commercial radio brand, eventually selling a business including LBC for £170 million. His Chrysalis TV successes include the Midsummer Murders detective drama series broadcast on ITV in the UK and over 225 TV channels around the world. Chris was also the owner of Queen's Park Rangers FC and the majority shareholder and chairman of Wasps Rugby Club. Now Chris is returning to the music business with the revival of the Chrysalis music brand. Chris, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, very welcome.
So how does a farmer's son from rural Lincolnshire make it in the music business?
I just don't know. I mean, it is quite a bizarre thing to think that I did start off on a farm in the, you know, in not just rural Lincolnshire, but very rural Lincolnshire. I just don't know. I mean, it's pretty quirky to think that it happened like that.
Were you always fiercely ambitious growing up?
I guess I probably was. I mean, it's interesting to think about things like that because I don't think you ever think yourself that you're ambitious. And I never thought I was ambitious, but clearly I was ambitious. And looking back on it, I can see things that I did early on in my life that makes me realise that, you know, I was pretty intensely, you know, committed to getting things off the ground and making them work. And my mother, actually, she once had a sort of a psychic that she was working with when we were living at Woodhall Spa after my father sold the farm. There was, you know, people used to go there for the waters, you know, it's like they do with those places, spas. And my mother told me that this woman she was working with said, "You've got a son. He's going to be very successful." And God knows where that came from. But my mother reminded, she didn't tell me at the time, but she reminded me of it later. So I don't know how these things are set in stone, but they seem to be.
How old were you when you started to realise that you know, that success was kind of about to manifest itself? Did you realise that you worked harder than other people, for example, or did you start to get a sense that other people were less ambitious than you? When did you start to get those entrepreneurial green shoots?
I don't think until later, really. I suppose, you know, at Manchester University, when I started running the music there, that would be the first time I did that. But thinking back, I did, when I started my table tennis club and the youth club in the village. I mean, we had a disused old chicken hut, big one, and I converted it into a youth club and put a table tennis table in there and other things. And I think back, well, that was a bit of a strange thing to do, and I got everybody to join and started a table tennis team, and we did very well and, you know, got promoted to the top division and won everything in sight almost and played in the county league. And it all started from me thinking, there's a disused chicken shed, let's see if we can do something with it. So I suppose looking back at that, which is something I've never mentioned to anybody before, but, you know, I was probably pretty good at organising things and seeing opportunities, if you think back to that old chicken shed.
So when you saw the opportunity when you were at Manchester University to start booking these bands, was that done primarily from a love of music first and foremost, or were you thinking about it commercially right from then?
No, not at all, really. Again, it was all by accident. I think, you know, one's life is a series of crossroads, and you come to a crossroad and you just don't know whether you're going to turn left, right, or go straight on. And sometimes, you know, it's just the itch on your shoulder that decides, oh, I'm going to go right. And so you go right, and, you know, it's completely put you in a completely different career path. And I didn't set about, or, you know, intending to organise all the entertainment at university. I didn't set about being at Manchester University. I didn't plan on being at a place that was, like, full of, you know, music business and music vibes at the time, being so close to Liverpool when the Beatles were breaking out of Liverpool and there was a big Manchester music scene as well. That was all by accident. I got elected to the student council. In fact, it was a friend of mine that put me up to it, that he genuinely thought the music wasn't very good. I wasn't perhaps quite so sure about it, but he was clearly right. And he suggested that, you know, I should be the person to change the music. I got elected to the student council, and I was initially just the assistant to another chap doing the music, but he left soon after, despite the fact his degree course wasn't finished. So I was thrust into the hot seat at a time when it was just very exciting and there were loads of opportunities, and we changed the face of student music by moving it from, you know, traditional jazz and dance bands and old style music to the burgeoning, you know, pop and blues and music that was happening all over England, and booking acts from America and God knows what. And up until then, no university had ever done that. It just didn't happen. You get used to it now. Universities, big hotbeds of music, and maybe, I don't know about today, but they certainly for a long time after that. But, you know, I started that, so I don't know. It just happened.
At this point, where were you in your mind's eye? Did you think this was an interesting, profitable diversion while you were a student, or did you think of this as the kind of beginnings of your business career in rock music?
Well, I didn't get paid for doing it. It was just what I did as part of the student council. There were other people on the council with me. Anna Ford, for one, was a friend of mine. She was on the student council. You know, a couple of people have been successful in politics and so forth. We just worked together. That was my responsibility, was the music. I didn't see it as being a job. I didn't see it as being a job until you know, after I left university. It was very much all-consuming, yes. I got my degree. I got a decent degree. I think what probably changed it was when a friend of mine, well, he actually wasn't that close a friend at the time, but he had come from London and been involved with Eel Pie Island and the Marquee Club and like Giorgio Gomelski, that originally managed the Yardbirds and was involved with the Stones. And there had been a student club, a music club, there one night a week, and he took it over and he wanted me to partner with him on it. And I'm not really quite sure why, but he thought that I was the route to getting the best groups, because I was already getting the groups for the university. And so we started this club one night a week on a Thursday night, and we got groups coming from all over. Didn't pay them much money, and the place was like heaving, you know. I mean, it was about 50 degrees Fahrenheit in there, and all the students listening to you know, really good blues music and dancing away. And frankly, we made quite a bit of money out of it. And I didn't do an awful lot. I just booked the bands and looked after the bands. He did all the promotion and the posters and took the money at the door. And at the end of the evening, we went back to his digs and split the money.
But was there a light bulb moment there? You know, in the cartoons when the dollar signs replace the pupils?
No, but it was, in a way, it was a series of stages, because at the end of my degree, I didn't know what to do. And I didn't really want to leave the university, because I was doing very well with you know, enjoying putting on the shows at the university and doing very well with this J&J club. So I quite liked to stay, and I just wasn't ready to go. And I got an offer to go to the University of Chicago to study political science there as a PhD. And I thought, wow, this is great. But I thought, well, you know, I'm giving up quite a lot if I do that. And I went to see my tutor, and he said, well, they've just started this place called the Manchester Business School. Why don't you go there? So I said, okay, because I didn't particularly want to go to the Manchester Business School, but it was buying me another year. So I went to the Manchester Business School, had another year when I was doing all of my student stuff and the J&J Club, and I was doing quite well financially because of that. And then, of course, suddenly, you know, that came to an end, and then I had to get a job. But I never thought that I could make a living out of doing what I was doing. I just assumed, okay, game's up, you know.
On to the next thing.
Yeah, into the real world.
But you've obviously have made a living of it in the real world, in a very successful one too. When did the idea come that you could continue it beyond kind of linked to an academic institute?
Well, I was looking for a job and I didn't have any money. I was living off whatever expenses I could get for doing interviews. And I came down to London. I went for an interview I was getting so many different interviews, I got confused. I thought it was with an advertising agency, but it clearly wasn't. But I didn't realise that at the time. I went in this sort of huge office with this sort of Eastern European chap sitting at the end, you know, behind this big desk. And I tell him about how keen I am to work in advertising business and so forth. And he said, Mr. Wright, I think I'd better tell you what this company does. I said, yes. He said, we are the biggest importer and exporter of steel in the United Kingdom. I've always wanted to work in the import and export of steel.
I like the pivot, though. It takes balls to do that.
Anyway, he then said, Mr. Wright, how would you like to go to America? I said, well, I'd love to. He said, well, because we're recruiting for our American operation and the chap that runs that's coming over next week, I'd like to put your name forward. I said, how long would I go for? He said, well, forever, of course. And then I got about this. I got on the train, went back to Manchester, went into the pub near one of the agencies where, you know, where we used to drink a little bit at nights. And the boss came in and said, what are you up to? I said, I don't know. I said, just been offered a job in America, I think, but I don't know whether I want to go. He said, well, what do you want to do? I have no idea. I can't make up my mind. He said, well, if you want to come and work for me, he said, you know, I won't pay you a salary, but, you know, I'll pay you just commission. He said, look, you know all the colleges. If you come, I'll give you a desk and a phone, sit in my office, try and book some groups into colleges where you know the social secretaries. I'll pay you commission on it, and you can do that whilst you're looking for a proper job.
I said, okay. Quite a generous offer, actually.
Yeah, I said, when do I start? He said, Monday morning. I said, okay. And that was it. I never had a proper job since.
Do you like not having a proper job then?
Absolutely. I mean, I do remember when years later when we sold the record company to EMI at the first half and I was still running it, and I did a tour around the world visiting all the licensees around the world, and I was in Australia. I had a meeting with at EMI's office in Australia with the managing director there. He was a chap called Peter Snell. I think he was the brother of Snell that had won Olympic medals running. You know, there was one. Anyway, we went out to dinner that night and the sat down, they said, he said to me, he said, within 5 minutes of meeting you, I realise you are totally unemployable.
Yeah. But what is it about you that makes it you unemployable? I mean, because lots of people are attracted to self-employment for different reasons. Is it the lack of a boss? Is it the lifestyle choice? Or is it like you want to make money or build something? Lots of different entrepreneurs I work with have different motivations, even though they end up at the same place.
I've never wanted to make money. Making money has never been a motivation. I don't know whether I'm unique in that respect, but I don't think that making money is a motivation for success with most people. And I would imagine that there are plenty of other people out there that would probably, if they wouldn't say the same thing, they'd probably still think the same thing. And I don't think that's got anything to do with it. In terms of why I'm unemployable, I don't think I've never been employed. I've never had a job. So I've always been used to doing my own thing, and I don't think I sit comfortably in corporate structures.
Let's talk some specifics now, because, I mean, you kind of spotted Blondie, didn't you? They were a bar band in New York, and you were kind of instrumental in creating that punk new wave scene. How did that all come about?
Well, I have to be very honest and say that of the various successes I've had over the years, a lot of it is down to other people and not myself. And in the case of Blondie, it was my ex-partner at the time that was fundamentally responsible for bringing Blondie into the company. I didn't have a lot to do with it. I made one decision when he called me up and said there's a group called Blondie. They're really good. He described and said they're signed to a label called Private Stock, which was run by a chap called Larry Utile. It was a pop label. And he said they're on the wrong label, and you know, I really think we should sign them. The only trouble is that he wants $500,000... to buy out the contract. Now, that was probably the most that anyone's ever paid to buy a record contract at the time. People, on the whole, don't buy record contracts. I think RCA probably bought Elvis Presley's contract from Sun, you know, in the late 50s or something like that. But I don't think they paid $500,000 for it. And Terry said that. He said, what do you think? All I said was, I think we should do it, go for it.
And what was he thinking at the time? I mean, as you've just explained there, that's quite an unprecedented decision. It's a lot of money to lose if you get it wrong, and music is inherently subjective. How do you know that these guys are the real deal and they're going to be a massive success, or they're just going to die death?
Well, you never do you? And you know, every time you make a decision signing a group, there is a big commitment. And, of course, you get it wrong. You can't not get it wrong, and there's always ones that don't work.
Well, you famously sent away David Bowie, didn't you?
Well, actually, that's another story. I mean, we signed David Bowie as a songwriter, which was, you know, a fantastic thing to do. And I was on tour in the States at the time when he delivered the Hunky Dory album. He didn't have a record deal. We were in prime position to pick it up for what was a very, very new burgeoning Chrysalis Records. And my ex-partner listened to it and he didn't like the record and he turned it down. And I never heard it until I got back from the States. And then I did hear the album because we were the publisher of the songs. And I thought, what a fantastic record. How could you have turned it down? So Terry got one right and he got one wrong. But there you go, that's the business.
It's the subjective nature, isn't it, as you've just said. Mm. What's it like working with these kind of musicians? Are they difficult to work with? I know you've worked with people like Sinead O'Connor and people like that. Do you have to kind of go into handling musician and pop star mode, or can you just be yourself with them?
You can't really be yourself with them all the time, no. You've got to handle creative people in a certain way. And, you know, it can apply to creative people in... you know, other areas outside of just the music business. But, you know, the kind of person that gets up on the stage in front of lots of people, perhaps when hasn't had any success, even when he's an opening act and plays his instrument or sings his songs and thinks that, you know, they're going to like him, there's a certain, you know, psyche and certain ego about that that makes them different from you and me. I mean, I can't speak about you, but I mean, you can talk about attributes I have. But, you know, getting up on stage with a guitar in front of 10,000 people...
takes real courage.
It does, in a way. And I mean, but it also takes a great belief in their own ability. And I think with musicians that you work with, if things go right and their career's successful, it's because they're brilliant. If anything goes wrong, it's because someone else screwed up, like the manager, the record company or whatever. And... you know, working with musicians, you've got to make sure that, in a way, they think it's their idea. You've got to get them to do the right thing. You can't tell them what to do because they won't take any notice. You've got to lead them very carefully, you know, to believing that they thought of it first. And of course, some of them are very difficult. That you've got the male-female situation. The guitarists are usually more difficult than the drummers. The bass players are usually the easiest to deal with. I mean, it's all, you know, you just have to, you know, adjust to it and cope with it.
Do you think artists have got more commercial over the years that you've worked in the industry? I mean, nowadays you look at bands like One Direction and, you know, they've been put together by, you know, record companies, and they seem to be very commercially and social media aware. Or do you say it's always like that? You look at the Monkees, for example, and say, well, they were a manufactured band.
You're almost asking two separate questions.
Could you answer them both? Both yes. Of them are interesting.
Are artists more commercial than they used to be? And less artistic? Yes, they are. I think in general, a creative, artistic artist is, you know, because the business is so much bigger, it's so much more sophisticated, you've got to understand so many different facets of it, that the stakes are so big and so forth. Yes, the successful artists are people that can comprehend all of that. Whereas in the old days, you know, drinking too much, smoking too much, you know, grass or, you know, that kind of thing, you know, and somebody else will pick up the pieces, fine. But, you know, it's not quite so easy to do that today without being on top of what you're doing. The second part of your question, talking about whether the difference between an artist and a manufactured pop star, because they're very, very different people. An artist is someone that creates music first and foremost, that wouldn't be doing what he was doing if he didn't, you know, if he wasn't incredibly talented. The manufactured pop stars are people that went on a reality TV show. They could have gone on Made in Chelsea or Love Island, but they got on The X Factor. They got into a group. They're basically told what to sing and what to wear, and they don't write their own songs. And, you know, that's a different kind of person. And yes, there's a lot of that about these days, much more than there ever was before, but it's not the first time it's happened, because that's exactly what the Monkees were, and that was a long time ago.
And have you always been on the more kind of musically inspired side rather than the manufactured side?
I've never been any good with the manufactured side. And Every time I've tried doing the manufactured side, I've kind of fallen flat on my face. There are other people, like a Simon Cowell, who maybe wouldn't have been any good whatsoever at the side of music that I was involved in. And he's very good at what he does. I don't think I could do what he does, because I don't really enjoy it. It's not something that I really empathise with, and I don't think I'd be successful at it. Do I listen to the music? Yes, some of the songs are, you know, and the music is great, but it's not, there's not an artist there speaking to me. There's a record that might be good to hum along to.
You mentioned in your memoirs that you threw yourself into the kind of sex, drugs and rock and roll lifestyle of the 70s. I admit in advance that I'm already jealous of that, having missed that by several decades. But tell us about that. I mean, what was it really as fun as the documentaries and the dramas suggest?
I mean, if you watch the film Almost Famous, and then, you know, you might watch and think, oh my God, that could never happen. It was, you know, I wouldn't say a bland version of what went on, but it was a pretty close, you know, version of what life was really like in those days.
So come on then, spill the beans. What did you get up to?
Well, I mean, I can't really. It was a fantastic time. I went to the States. I got on a plane in June 1968, you know, almost wearing a suit with short hair and a briefcase. And you get thrown into San Francisco, and I came back with long hair, a leather jacket, a beard, and a hippie shoulder bag. And, you know, you can't say, I don't want to be part of it. I mean, if you're in the Fillmore West or any of those places like that, the amount of grass that was smoked, it was just unbelievable. And you didn't realise it at the time, but, I mean, you were as high as everybody else, even though you said, oh, no, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. But, I mean, you couldn't not be, because it was just...
Literally in the atmosphere.
Yes.
Passive yes. Smoking.
And the music industry then was in a kind of a renaissance stage. The groups were fantastic, the music was fantastic, everybody was totally focused on music. There was nothing else that a young person was interested in. Films were kind of like bullshit, and you know, there was no technology or anything like that. It was all music, and you were totally focused on music. There were so many great groups and so many great bands, and you had the backdrop of the Vietnam War, and you can't take away the impact of that on everything, because as you're going around doing gigs, every gig you're coming to, there's kids that are coming backstage, some that have come back that are crippled and all of that kind of thing, others that got their draft papers that morning and it's like their last night before they're shipped off there. This was a war that was on the TV screens every day. 550,000 young American draftee kids were sent to Vietnam. 65,000 came back dead. Everybody knew somebody. Everybody had a friend, a schoolmate, the guy you sat next to in class, the kid from the corner that you played games with after school that had gone to Vietnam and come back in a coffin or come back, you know, severely wounded. And it was always likely to be your day when the draft papers came, and that was a huge backdrop.
And the veterans were treated terribly when they were returned as well.
Well, they were, because the veterans were treated terribly when they were returned, because it wasn't a war that anybody sympathised was. You know, the people weren't thinking, that poor guy's gone there to save my life and save my future for my kids and my grandchildren. It was like, what are we doing there in the first place, in these terrible conditions, fighting a war we can't win? And it united the whole youth movement, and music was the anthem that, you know, that enveloped the whole thing. Was it a fantastic time to live in? Yes. Is it the best time that I've ever had in my life? Yes. Was it because it was just fun? No. It was because it was just an all-consuming, really interesting time to live, and a really interesting experience to be involved in a major way. It was fantastic.
What kind of business things were you up to? I mean, what was your role within Chrysalis at the time? Was it more like HR management, hiring and firing, or were you hands-on with the acts? Was it more on a kind of A&R side or PR? What were you actually doing in a typical week?
I think in those days, you know, it was all about A&R. There wasn't much else other than A&R, artist development and promotion. I mean, you didn't have other means of promoting groups and promoting records other than live appearances and radio play. There wasn't much else to it than that. It was all about getting the music right, and my focus and the focus of my partner was in basically dealing with the artists, signing the artists, working with them, getting them doing the right tours in the right places at the right times, making the right records with the right people, and hoping that, you know, you get them promoted in the right way. And we had other people in the company taking care of, you know, the different facets of it. But my job was the most important job of all, which was finding the right artists, making the right records, making those artists successful. The rest of it someone else could deal with.
Why did you feel it was time to move on then? I mean, you ended up selling Chrysalis to Thorn EMI. Tell us about that.
We got to the point as a record company where we were almost like we were too big to be an independent and too small to be a major. We were carrying a really large overhead, especially in the States. We had, I think at the time, about 75, 80 people working for us in the States. That's quite a number. It's quite an overhead that you've got a service. We had successful artists, but to be fair, some of our major artists had problems at that time. Blondie, you know, had a big issue. I mean, sure, there were drugs involved in Blondie's case, which didn't help. That took them off the scene for, you know, in a big way, when they were, at the time, you know, if not the biggest act in the world, certainly one of the biggest few acts in the world. Billy Idol had a huge drug problem at the time as well. We were kept waiting for a new Billy Idol album. That never came. Huey Lewis and the News went off the boil. You know, with situations over here, I mean, it wasn't too bad over here, really. You know, we had Ultravox and Spandau Ballet were doing pretty well. Ultravox and Spandau Ballet, yes, I mean, they were doing well. But in America, that was a big problem, because we never really broke Spandau Ballet in America. And that was partly at the time I was, you know, my partner and I weren't getting on great. He was running the American company. They didn't work on the record. They didn't see it as being a record for America. You know, it could have been right, it could have been wrong. But, I mean, they didn't give it a proper airing, and we ended up, you know, falling out with Spandau Ballet over it. I promised them we'd do a better job on the record in America, and we didn't do the job. I couldn't deliver on it.
If you feel you can talk about it, why do you feel it came to an end with your business partner then? What were the seeds of you falling out there at the beginning?
You know, Terry's quite a complicated person. I might be a complicated person. I think that maybe we both like to run things. I think, you know, when we were managing different groups or working on different groups within the company, you know, then it was fine because we were both contributing. I was looking after, you know, these groups. He was looking after those groups. And that was fine. When he was managing the US company, I was managing the rest of the company. That was fine. He decided to move back to England. I think we started treading on each other's toes. That didn't help. I think he had some issues himself at the time, which he will admit to. And it became very difficult for us working together. And it became very difficult managing what had become quite a big business at the time and giving the direction to the key people that, you know, that were necessary to running the business. And I think there was really ultimately only one solution to it.
You speak to a lot of entrepreneurs and they say the bigger the business gets in terms of headcount, the more headaches you get and the joy is lost a little bit along the way.
Well, that is true, yes. I think, when you're your own person, the bigger the business gets, the business can only get bigger if you're able to delegate. And if you're going to delegate successfully, you need good people to delegate to. And good people don't like being told what to do. You know, you've got to give good people the opportunity to make their own mistakes. You can't say to a good person, go and do it like this, and this is how you do it, and so forth. For that, you just need a robot or an assistant or somebody. You know, if you want to work with good people, you've got to put up with somebody coming in and saying, I really love this group. I think this is the way we should go with it. I think this is the record we should release. I think this is what we should do. I think this is the program we should make. You've got to let them get it. You might think, well, I think it's completely wrong. But, you know, you've got to say, if you really believe that, you can question them. You say, if you really believe it, go and do it. And it's hard for some people to do that. And, you know, justifiably so. But you have to. Otherwise, there's going to be a ceiling on how big that organisation can grow, because you can't do everything yourself.
Tell us what came next then.
When we sold 50% of the record company in 89. I mean, we basically had cash flow problems, especially in America. In hindsight, I think I should have just closed down the American operation and got rid of the overhead, retrenched to the UK. America's a graveyard for foreign companies. They don't like foreign companies. They are basically an isolationist country. They don't like foreigners going there and doing well. And it is tough. And I should have closed down the American company. But I didn't want to do that. So I did the 50-50 partnership with EMI. But of course, EMI was, you know, the gorilla, and we were a little rabbit in the relationship, and they didn't really want a 50-50 partnership. That it was just their means to buying the whole thing, and so they structured a situation where they bought the whole thing. And in 1991, they took over the other half of the record company, and there I was left with no record company. So,
and did he feel, was that a good thing at that point, or did he feel free?
No, I mean, I basically had nightmares for 6 months. I mean, it's not what I wanted to do. You know, people on the outside might think, well, that was a smart move, you know, getting rid of a record company, you know, a few years before the record business started really hitting the skids and so forth. But no, it wasn't what I wanted to do. But I was left with what we had in the rest of the company, which was music publishing and a outside broadcast facilities company, recording studios, but, you know, other bits and pieces. And, you know, so I decided I'd try and rebuild something out of the ashes, in a way. And that's what, you know, we were able to do. And I think, in a way, that is probably after the period sort of 68 to 72 in the music business, when, you know, every day something great was happening, the next best period of my life was when I kind of recreated Chrysalis in the early mid 90s, and the different areas that we moved into, because, you know, I think in a way that was more of an achievement than the first time round.
What made you decide to go into radio? Because I know you launched Heart, the commercial radio brand, you bought LBC, and obviously very successfully sold that to Global for, I think, $170 million.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think commercial radio does have a future? There's several questions for you in one.
Well, at the time, commercial radio was really opening up. I mean, we had a period when commercial radio was very limited in England. You had LBC and Capital in London, and then you had one or two other things like the Virgin Radio, National Rock on the AM band. But the Radio Authority were opening up commercial radio right across the country in quite a major way. So there was an opportunity. We had taken an investment in a company that operated radio stations in Yorkshire and the Northeast. That was sold out. We made a profit on our investment, but, you know, we learned enough about the radio business, and Richard Huntingford, who was the director responsible for it, particularly got involved in it, and we decided that we would apply for some of these licenses. And we applied for one in Manchester, and we didn't get it, and we put a lot of money, a lot of effort into that, and we thought probably that was it. And then they were doing another one a bit later for Birmingham, a regional station in Birmingham. These regional stations were bigger than just the one city. They spread out, you know, they were regional stations, not city stations. And we applied for the one in Birmingham, except for the one in Birmingham. We basically rehashed the Manchester application, except we didn't have any extra shareholders or anything like that. And, I mean, we didn't think much about it. We didn't expect to win it, and lo and behold, we won it. And there we were. We had the opportunity to start what became Heart in the Midlands, which did become one of the most successful radio stations in the country in terms of market share and success and everything like that.
Still a great brand now.
It is. And then we applied for one in London. We got Heart in London, and then we were able to move the Heart brand into other areas. We bought a Galaxy station in South Wales and Bristol, which was a dance pop station that allowed us to do the same thing with getting Galaxy stations in Yorkshire and Manchester. And then we bought LBC, which was probably... No, it was. I mean, it was a mistake buying LBC. When we bought LBC, it was losing $3 million a year, and when we spent a lot of money trying to make it work better, and I think it continued to lose $3 million a year. It was very hard to do anything different with it than what had been happening before. It didn't matter how much you improved the programming, that the listenership is quite old. Advertisers aren't that keen on reaching old people. Advertisers want to reach the people that listen to stations like Heart. Advertisers really want to get to like 26 to 40 year old housewives. They're the ones that spend the money on things that, you know, people want to sell, not sort of 55, 60 year old people that are listening to, you know, talk radio. They don't really buy anything. So, you know, it was tough. And of course, the programming costs are a great deal higher because you've got to pay presenters and news coverage and things like that. I think LBC is doing a great job under its current owners. I've no idea what the bottom line's like. I would be very impressed if they've been able to improve it enormously from where it was when we had it. I mean, the things they're doing, great, yes. But I mean, we tried, we did do a lot of things, like we were always a London station. But I think the biggest problem you've got is, one, in other markets of the world where talk radio is successful, you don't have the BBC. The BBC is a phenomenally successful, very good media operation.
But it stifles commercial competition, doesn't it?
Well, it does stifle commercial competition. And when I was when I owned commercial radio stations, I hated the BBC. Now I don't own commercial radio stations. I don't say I love the BBC because I think there's a lot of things wrong with it. But, you know, if there's an incident in, you know, Abu Dhabi right now, the BBC are there. They're covering it. I mean, to replicate that with the commercial station is just impossible. And to even try is expensive. That's the big problem, is that in the programming, you're competing with the BBC's programming ability and with all of their reach on that. And the other side is the fact that the advertisers don't want to pay too much money to reach older people.
So you went into radio and you built up quite a phenomenal number of brands, but then you felt it was time to leave and sell to Global.
Well, I would have sold the radio business a bit before we did. We sat around the board table. I mean, radio became hugely flavour of the month. We sat around the board table. The guy that was running the radio division said it was worth $400 million. I thought, well, you know, he's crazy. It's not anything like that. If we could get $400 million, it would be like the sale of the century. I think the froth was coming off the top. We talked about it. We can't sell it because actually most of the shareholders, we're a public company, most of the shareholders have only invested in it because of radio. But of course, they'd have loved us to have sold it at the top of the market because, you know, they soon decided that radio had reached the top of its cycle and it was the time to sell it. And by the time we sold radio business, there wasn't a huge queue of people to buy it like there had been a few months before. And we were trying to buy other radio station operators. And we couldn't. We knew we needed to get bigger. We were trying to buy other stations. We couldn't buy them. If we couldn't get bigger, we knew we'd be squeezed by the two biggest operators, and we had to consider the fact that we would sell it.
When you did sell it, though, you felt that was the right time. You were glad to move on at that point, were you?
I was. I'm not sure if the rest of the board were, but I definitely was. I just regretted that, in a way, we took a much lower price than we would have taken if we'd sold it 6 months or a year before.
And do you think commercial radio will always be in a kind of inevitable decline, that whilst they're making the best of it, the sheer number of internet radio stations, you know, you've got the DAB spectrums with dozens. I mean, I turned my radio on in the office today, there's about 40 radio stations. I was genuinely dumbfounded, thinking, what am I going to listen to?
Yeah, I think so. And also, you know, people streaming and listening, you know, Spotify and listening to Spotify playlists that, you know, can give you the same kind of thing with the music that you really want, niche-wise, without adverts and so forth. But I think if you're listening to radio, you're listening to it for, you know, for a sense of community as well. Mm-hmm. The stations have got to play really good music. There are music programs that are almost appointments to listen to. But on the whole, I would really listen to radio in the car and not many other places. And in the car, of course, you can listen to CDs and music without listening to radio.
Do you think Spotify is killing it? Because, I mean, for example, you can listen to BBC Six Music on the radio, but you can also listen to their playlist on Spotify and have the same music with no DJ.
Well, there you go.
Do you think that's going to ultimately kill radio?
I don't think it's ultimately going to kill it, because if you're in the car, you listen to radio because you're going to, if there's going to be a traffic incident ahead, you're going to hear about it. If there's a breaking news big incident, you're going to hear about it, you know, and things like that. So in a car, I think music radio and talk radio and sport, you know, are really big things. And I don't think anything's ever going to take the place of radio in a car. But radio at home, yes, I think it's, you know, I'd be surprised how many people listen to radio at home.
So I'm always inspired by the entrepreneurial journey, and I love reading books by successful business people like yourself, and just, you know, find out what you, I should do, emulate in terms of what you've done that's successful, and not do the bits where you know, people like yourself are very, very open and honest and say, these are the mistakes, and think, right, I'm not going to do that. And your story is incredibly inspirational, right up to the point where you get involved in sport, because I know nothing about sport, and you bought two clubs, I mean, QPR and Wasps. Tell us about that, and tell us about the journey. Because it's something that I just think I would never do.
No, well, you'd be right never to
do
it.
Right, okay.
I mean, whatever you do, don't do that. It was pretty tough.
Did you always want to own a sports team? You know, some people starting out on their entrepreneurial journey say, I want to be a billionaire. I want to be a billionaire, but I never want to own a sports team.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do want to own a... I mean, it's like the ultimate train set, isn't it? And why does a Roman Abramovich own Chelsea? I mean, you know, for a man of his wealth, it's the ultimate train set.
Tell us about, you know, how it came to be, you know, how you started it. What were the motivations?
I had owned a basketball team. We had, as part of Chrysalis Television, we had a very large sports production company. We produced things like Formula One for ITV when it was on ITV. We produced a lot of football. We produced a lot of sport. And that company, in a different name and different guise, is still going. So I was involved with sport and sport broadcasting. I got to know a lot of people in sport. Basketball was on Sky at the time, British Basketball, and they wanted a team in Sheffield. The Basketball League wanted a team in Sheffield, and I said I would take it over and start it and run it. And so I owned a basketball team in Sheffield. There are very good facilities in Sheffield because of the World Student Games from, you know, a long time ago. They created some very good facilities ahead of its time for England. And the basketball went very well there, and I enjoyed it. And actually, it lost money, but it didn't lose a lot of money, but it was good fun. I perhaps should have just stuck to basketball. But then football was coming into an era where, you know, people saw it as, you know, generating big revenues. Of course, it is now generating not just big, but massive.
Colossal. The Premiership is unbelievable.
Unbelievable. But, you know, back in the mid-90s, this was on the horizon, but... And I'd been a supporter of QPR since I'd moved down, you know, from Manchester to London, and I used to go there regularly. And they'd been run by a family called the Thompsons, so actually I know personally through, you know, other things. And they'd been relegated with the lowest points total, I think, of a team ever was relegated by. Although maybe Aston Villa got relegated by more points this year, I don't know. And they wanted to sell it, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I could buy it. And a friend of mine was very keen on me doing that, and we had actually looked at a couple of other football teams that might have been for sale, and I couldn't quite see it working. And at the same time, I'd been approached by people connected with rugby, because rugby at the time was an amateur sport, played a lot on public parks and places like that. And the people that own Wasps, which were one of the bigger brands in rugby, two people came to see me. Actually, they weren't the people, they weren't important on the committee. They were just like fans to try and persuade me to get involved with Wasps. And I went to see where Wasps played. And I thought, you know, rugby's, you know, going into, it's going to be, you know, professional next year. How are you going to operate a professional sports team from where Wasps were at the time? And I was driving into London and realised that actually there was only about 3 or 4 miles between where Wasps played and where QPR played. And I sort of had one of those sort of, you know, light bulb moments and said, wow, well, why don't we put the two together, play them both at Loftus Road, and, you know, we'll double the revenue and without increasing the overhead. Sounded like a good idea at the time. And so that's why I did it.
Did you enjoy it? When did the wheels start to come off the bus, as it were? Because you kind of said that you, on balance, you think it's not worth the hassle.
There's no on balance about that. I mean, it's not. It's very, very difficult. I mean, don't forget at the time I was still running Chrysalis as a really major company. I was really busy with that. Chrysalis was probably at its most, you know, busy at the time with TV and radio and music and everything else that we were doing. I think you need a certain mentality to run a football club. You need to be a lot tougher. You know, having the sensitivity to deal with creative people isn't really an attribute that is much use when you're running a football club. You're better off, you know, being very hard-nosed. And, of course, you know, the first few games, you know, the fans love you and, you know, it's just the, you know, it's a dream. It's fantastic. But then, you know, you lose a match and you take it very badly and things go wrong and players get injured and, you know, you're desperately trying to be successful and you stretch out financially as much as you possibly can. And then, you know, the bottom line's affected and you know, well, we need a new striker. I know we haven't got the money. We've got to somehow or other, you know, beg, steal or borrow to get that new striker. And you do that and then, you know, he goes and breaks his leg or gets a, you know, knee ligament injury and
I'm stressed out just listening to it all. It sounds like a litany of hassle.
It is very difficult and it's a very difficult world to manage. There's a lot of strange people involved in football. I think you've only got to look at some of the agents that represent some of the biggest footballers in the world and, you know, read between the lines and you can think, God, you know, he looks a dodgy sort of person.
My friend Richard Conway is a sports correspondent at the BBC, and I know nothing about football, but he covers FIFA quite extensively. Yeah. And just from watching it on the nightly news, yeah. As someone who's not into sport, I look at it and think, who are these people, and how does this organisation even exist?
I know.
It's incredible.
How could people actually decide that we're going to hold the World Cup on a small little, is it an island or peninsula, in the Middle East, where the temperatures are 40, 50 degrees, where it's homophobic and you're not allowed to drink and they don't have any stadia.
Tell us about Chrysalis Television. I mean, you guys created Midsummer Murders. You sold it to hundreds of countries. Do you think that was the kind of precursor of these internationally recognisable formats like Downton Abbey? And if you don't mind me saying, do you think you sold it a bit too cheaply? I mean, you got about 50 million for that, didn't you?
We did become the first super indie.
I mean, Midsummer Murders is amazing.
Yes,
that's phenomenal.
I mean, we started off, we had TV facilities. We had outside broadcast trucks and we had a studio. We weren't producing anything. The first thing we started producing was the sport. We were the first company to produce Premier League football for the international market. I mean, there was no Premier League wasn't shown outside of England at the time. We got the contract to produce that. We had to do a dummy run with what's now, I think, or what was the Sherpa Van Trophy or whatever, with the final of that, which was actually a big final at Wembley. It was two pretty big teams, like sort of Blackburn and Wolves, or it wasn't, but I mean two teams that were at the time in the lower reaches. We did a very good job for that as a pilot. We got that contract and then we developed the sports programming side from that, and then we came up with the idea, or I must say it was probably my idea, of saying, I don't normally claim credit, but in this occasion it was, saying that like record companies would have one label for jazz and another label for classical, another label for hip-hop and so forth, that we would have different brand names, different production companies under a Chrysalis Television umbrella doing different kinds of programming. And we bought companies or brought in people to run different, you know, kind of programming within that. And yes, I mean, we did produce Midsummer Murders. We started that from the beginning. And it has been one of the most successful programs of all time. It has been phenomenal. Did we sell it too cheap? Far too cheap. I actually was totally opposed to selling it. I didn't want to sell it. I fought as hard as I could against selling it. I was in a minority on the board. We had a whole series of issues over, you know, just because I was the majority shareholder, you know, that we had to look to the other public institutions that were shareholders, that they'd bought shares because we were a radio company. We needed to buy more radio companies. TV production was not a great business, they thought, i.e. the city. And I was absolutely violently opposed to selling it. And we sold it far too cheap. We sold it for 50 million. The people that bought it from us sold it on, augmented slightly, for 315 million. There was the theory at the time that Midsummer Murders might not continue, for example. Who knows? You know, John Nettles could, you know, break a leg or something and, you know, that would be all over. Well, you know, that wasn't the case, and it's still doing well even without John Nettles. And frankly, when you consider a good chunk of the money we got for it, we spent on buying LBC, was it a good deal? No. But, you know,
ups and downs.
There were ups and downs. I mean, you know, it's hard to look back, but, it, you know, it's of all of the deals that we did, it still rankles with me that, you know, that because it's the only time that I insisted on the board minutes minuting the fact that I thought it was absolutely 100% the wrong thing to be doing.
Last question then, in two parts. You went into a period of kind of semi-retirement, and now you're coming out of that, relaunching Chrysalis. Tell us about, you know, what took you into that period, what you were doing, and also what you're doing now. Why are you taking that direction?
Well, after we sold the radio business in, and it was, I think, in 2007, and that was just before, you know, the financial world started imploding, we were left with music publishing and a few other bits and pieces. We had a very big music publishing business. We were still a public company. It wasn't really viable as a public company, and the shareholders were not terribly happy. They didn't really want to sell their shares because they knew that if they could force a sale of the company, they'd be able to, you know, get pretty big profit on their shareholding. So we got into a situation where we tried to sell the business or to merge it with someone else. It was all very complicated. In the end, that was eventually sold in 2011. And I was then kind of like retired. I didn't retire. I found other things to do. I was involved in quite a few startups and different things, some of which are still alive, some of which aren't still alive, some of which might be successful. But startups are bloody difficult. You know, just because you've got a great idea doesn't mean to say it's going to work. And then the opportunity arose to join up with three other chaps and buy back Chrysalis Records, the company that I'd sold in 1991. And it basically came about because when I'd sold Chrysalis Records to EMI back in 91, EMI was taken over by Guy Hans. He got into a mess with it, ended up having to sell EMI, which he sold to Universal. Universal had a EU Commission challenge on competition monopoly. They had to divest a chunk of what they'd bought. They managed to strip out the US signed artists as much as possible and sell other stuff onto Warner. And so Warner ended up owning Chrysalis Records without the US signed artists. And Warner themselves didn't actually have a referral to the EU Commission, but the independent record community kind of said to them, if you do a unilateral deal with us, then to divest some of the stuff into the independent sector, then we will not challenge you in Brussels. And that's how it came about that Warner was selling some of the assets they'd bought from Universal, one of which was Chrysalis. And Jeremy Lascelles, who had been my last chief executive of Chrysalis, had started a new company with Robin Miller, the record producer who had produced a lot of hits like the Sade album. They had asked me if I could become involved with it. I couldn't, because at the time I was still working as a consultant for BMG, who had bought the Chrysalis publishing business. But they had registered as being a certified bidder for these assets, and they asked me if I'd join them in, you know, coming on board to try and buy the Chrysalis record label. And we managed to do that. And so I'm now one of the partners in the newly resuscitated Chrysalis Records. And, you know, let's see where we can go with it. But, of course, it's a hugely emotional moment because it was the first company, and now, you know, we've been bought it back. It's not me entirely, but I'm one of four people, and I'm not actually on the shop floor running it, but I'm involved in everything that goes on. And, you know, it's only pretty new because we only concluded the deal, you know, a few weeks ago. But it's very exciting. And, yes, I've always been busy. When people ask me what I'm doing, I say, I'm busy. What are you doing? I don't know. I'm busy doing nothing, I say. But I'm always busy, but I'm busy doing nothing. Well, I've got a little bit more than nothing to be busy about. I've got a new TV production company, which we're called Chrisley's Vision, that we're working very hard on. That's with Roger Parry and Mick Pillsworth, who ran Chrisley's Television for us in the early days. We haven't got anything commissioned yet, but we've got an awful lot of interesting projects on the slate and a good team of people working on that. So I think that, you know, we'll get that off the ground. If you say, this week I've had a Chrisley's Records board meeting, I've had a Chrisley's Vision board meeting, I was at Goodwood Races yesterday. My next meeting is with a songwriter that signed to me that worked with Tim Rice on his last show, which is just opened in the States on an off-Broadway run in Finger Lakes. So, you know, there's never been anything typical, but the untypicality remains.
Chris, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you ever so much for your time.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!